Today, we've lined up for you three university librarians who are going to talk a bit about their experience in the acquisition, use, distribution, encouragement of the use, acquisition, and distribution of ebooks at their universities. Our first speaker is Kate Price, and she is the e-strategy and resources manager at the University of Surrey, and she's going to focus specifically on ebook use at university.
Thank you, Eileen. Oh, this is a bit strange. It's a pleasure to be here today. As Eileen mentioned, I work at the University of Surrey, which is a fairly small to medium-sized research-led institution in Guildford, about 25 miles outside London, so not very far for me to come. I have dispensed with my Shakespearean metaphor, you'll be glad to know. I was just talking to Jill about this earlier. I couldn't really work it enough to make it work properly, plus there are three of us presenting, so I have cut down into actual facts rather than metaphor, hopefully. So, cutting to the chase, academic ebook users, students. What is a student? What do they do? What do they want? One of the most important things that you need to know about students is that they do not want to spend money on academic resources. They have rent to make, they have to eat, they have to travel to and from the campus. Really, buying any sort of information resource and indeed printing off from any online information resource is fairly low on their scale of priorities. They're time poor, they're holding down a job maybe, part-time job. Quite a few of them have families, and this is particularly for our overseas contingencies, bring their families with them. They also are trying to fit in their academic studies. And one of the consequences about this is that they very much seek simplicity in what they do. They want everything to be there, very easy to use. If you're doing a module on nuclear energy, you want to have room in your head for the equations. You really don't want to be faffing about trying to find lots of different things from lots of different interfaces. They want it easy, quick, simple. One of the things about print books is there is one interface for a print book. It's your eyes. With internet ebooks, many, many different interfaces. And this is one of the frustrations that students come across. Quite often, they're not on campus much. We even have several hundred, even thousands, distance learners that never come to campus. So off-campus access is incredibly important for us. Again, the people with the jobs, the people with the families are not on campus having copious leisure time to sit and study in the library. We are currently open 24 hours a day, so people are coming in at 2 a.m. in the morning to study even. But they need to be able to access their information any time of day, from anywhere, ideally. And actually, what we find when we talk to our students is often they're not connected to the internet 24/7. A few of them have iPhones, a few of them have laptops through which they have wireless access, but a great many of them, even in their student houses, don't have broadband because they can't afford it. They come into the library particularly so they can get access to free internet, free wireless, free fixed computing. So what they do is they come to the library and they download stuff. And forget Twitter, this is the most important thing that's happened to students in the last 5 years, the Humble USB stick. It's ubiquitous, they all use it. They leave them in droves in computers in the library. This is how I know. Okay. So these have come down in cost massively. This one was free. It's from a publisher. I don't think they're represented here in the room, but free advertising, if you are. So what they do is they come and they harvest. They download, they download, they download. So then they've got a library in their pocket. And they take it away with them. The advent of the USB stick is actually tied in with a massive downturn in the amount of printing that students do, which I found quite interesting. I think they are intimately tied together, those two things. They're quick and easy to use. You don't need software for them. Once you've got it on your USB stick, you don't need myriads of different interfaces. You just upload it. It's in PDF or whatever. E-book readers, it's not on my slide, but as Daniel was talking about e-book readers, I'm a bit of a sceptic. One of the reasons why I'm a sceptic is because About 13 years ago, I was wandering around Tokyo's Akihabara district, as you do. I was wandering around the Sony building, and I came across something called the Sony Bookman. It was an e-book reader, and this was 13 years ago. It was a neat little gadget. Never actually made it to Europe. But one of the reasons I think, I'm a bit of a skeptic about e-book readers, and one of the reasons why I think they haven't really hit Europe yet, because of the smaller market, is that they do have an inherently small market. It's a gadget that is a one-use thing. What I think will happen is netbooks becoming a lot cheaper. This is a little cut-down laptop, not much software on it, doesn't have Microsoft on it, therefore it's very, very cheap. Students can afford it, and they can do multiple things with it. Your e-book reader is for one thing only, for reading. It might have audio, great, but your average student wants to do things with the text. They're not just reading it for fun, they're reading it for work and study. So they need to be able to cut bits out, copy bits, make quotations, they need to create citations, they need to input citations into reference manager and EndNote. They need to be able to stick all of this into a document, an office document, Word document, a presentation, a PowerPoint. They need to then email it to their professor and share it with other students that they're working in groups with. A netbook is way more functional for that sort of thing. You can put on that open source office type software, Red Hat, Linux, whatever, and it becomes a multiple tool. An e-book reader doesn't do that for you. It may do in the future, but you're not going to pay £250 for something that only does one thing. Not that many students have iPhones yet. Again, I think that needs, the price needs to come down massively before that becomes ubiquitous too. So, moving on to academics. Academics, again, are time poor. They have been the most sceptical people about e-books in my personal experience, and that's largely because they don't see why. Academics don't come into the library, as Jill was mentioning earlier. They access all their journal information, and as a science and technical university, they are using journal information, not book information. They have a very low opinion on spending money for students. So I have to fight my corner on that one, and I do it successfully. But yeah, academics are not great fans of e-books. But on the plus side, we have something called the National Student Survey. And every year in the National Student Survey, and in all of our library surveys going back to the year dot, students say they don't have enough books. There's not enough copies of the books they want. And every library survey that any library's ever done in the academic sphere has always found that. I can't, bar none, I don't think. Because we can't buy a book for every student. So one of the things that academics want to do is boost their ratings in the National Student Survey, so hence they want to jockey a little bit for demand there, and they want to do what the students think is a good thing, a little bit. They're a little bit conflicted. They're also not on campus much at times. So they are away researching, they're in China, whatever. So they want stuff online. They don't want to have to faff about in a library. Students, more about students, we love students. Students want everything via the same interface, as I was mentioning. They don't have the brain space to learn 10 different interfaces. They also don't use features that require them to register a separate username and password. They don't have room in their brains for more than one username and password. One of the great things that's happened in the last few years is being able to use our Active Directory for single sign-on to lots of different things, including Athens, DA, Shibboleth, what have you. Students just think that's great. If you ask them to set up another password interface account, they hate you, basically. This is a message, actually, for if you're thinking about setting up anything pay-per-view, use something that's already in use, like PayPal. Don't set up individual accounts. Just a tip for you. As I was mentioning, they harvest material from lots of sources and save. They're not brand loyal. It was interesting about Richard's presentation earlier about don't use aggregators. Really, our students want everything through the same interface. Therefore, libraries, students love aggregators. We want everything through one aggregator, basically. Librarians love aggregators too because it cuts down on our complication in terms of acquisition. If we had to deal with every publisher separately, it would be a nightmare. Similarly, with printed books, we like to deal through a library supplier because that makes our workflow very, very easy. That's just an aside, really. They try not to print because it costs money, but many of them tell me, personally, that they do prefer to read on paper. One of the reasons I believe, personally, although I don't know, this may Jill may contradict me later about this, but I personally believe that people look through the e-book to get an idea, and then they would prefer to borrow the print book. I actually had quite an irate student come in at the weekend and say, "You have far too many e-books, I just want the print." And it just so happens we have packages of e-books for background reading that we don't have in print, and she was most distressed about that, I have to say. But for all of these people that have a problem with it, there are many, many more that really enjoy having an online experience. So, you know, how are people reading books? Just having a survey saying, "I do read e-books," is not the whole story. I think there's another side to that, which is that we don't actually have a lot of research on how people use print books. Print books are very diverse, they're there for lots of different reasons. There's lots of different sorts of information in them, and people use them in different ways. But going on quickly, availability is the main reason why students like e-books. You can access them 24/7. You don't have to carry massive books around. Some of our students have little wheelie trolleys that they have books in. They cut all of that out. Unlimited loan period, they love that. No fines, great. I was talking to some of our staff that deal with those with special needs, disabilities, those with dyslexia. They love e-books. It means they can have unlimited access. They have a longer time to read and digest the information. They can go back through, and also many of them have audio features too, so they think that's absolutely brilliant. But I would say that PDFs have to be disability DDA compatible, so have openable PDFs, so screen readers can use them. Many, many students see it as exciting and new. They want more e-books, actually. They want every book that's on a reading list to be an e-book there when they need to do their essay. All students, at least up until PhD, maybe even beyond, wait until one day before their essay is due in before they write it, and of course all of the books have gone out by then. That is why they like e-books. That is a great secret behind them. But one of the problems is that the books they that are on their required reading list are not actually available as e-books yet, and I believe Roel's going to talk about this a little later. So a few student comments. These are actually taken from the National E-Books Observatory Project's survey, local results from the University of Surrey. Last time round, there have been two surveys. We haven't got the local results for the next one just yet. But the sort of things that come through are more books online, !! We want more. It would be great if all the popular textbooks are available as e-books. There are often only one or two copies available of the newer texts. There could definitely be opportunity to extend the range of e-books. So one of the frustrations is on the reading list, they've been recommended the 3rd, 4th, 5th edition, and the e-book is lagging behind by at least one edition. This is very frustrating for us as librarians too, because we try and acquire an e-copy of everything that's an essential reading item. So, onto discovery. Yes, e-books are great if the MART records are in the catalogue. Surrey doesn't have a federated search system, but one of the things that would really make e-books great is if they're available for cross-search. They're not great on cross-search just yet. One of the things that happens is that not enough metadata fields are really available for cross-search for e-books. You maybe get the title, occasionally you get chapter headings that aren't abstracts like they are with journals. Okay, if you go to an aggregator that might have 30% of your e-books on it, you can cross-search it, but that's only 30%. And in many cases, if you're going directly to publishers, it's a lot lower. Negative from our point of view is MART records can be frustratingly slow to arrive, often inaccurate. If you're selling to an aggregator, do make sure that the MART records that are there from the aggregator are accurate. Sometimes the MART tags are missing, so we can't import them. They're unusable. If we can't import MART records, then they're effectively invisible to our users. They don't go to the internet searching for particular e-books, usually. And just to reiterate, most users don't start at the interface level for ebooks, so they don't cross search whole packages. Most of our users are going straight to the ebook itself, not to the top level interface. Usability. If there's one thing you take away from this, I would say users are deeply, deeply, deeply frustrated by DRM restrictions. It's the one thing that comes out time and time again. If somebody's talking to me, and also the academic liaison librarians go to course boards and we get student feedback from that, and the academics get feedback from the students and the academics pass it on to that, this is the one thing that comes through from all of those different channels. And I was very heartened that Springer don't put DRM on. I would make a plea for everybody to do the same. Because they're not thieves, they're not going to steal, they're students. They can't make a profit out of reselling it. Nobody is really going to buy a chapter from an ebook from a student on eBay. They're not. So I would say, please don't put DRM on. It is very, very, very frustrating for the end user. They want to be able to dip in, save things, as I mentioned. They might want to save three or four chapters. At the moment, they're prevented from doing that. They can have maybe a little bit of a chapter. They can take that away on their USB stick to read later. But then they might want to read three or four other chapters from the same book, and they can't do so. Those that want to be able to print, to be able to read more comfortably, also find this very, very frustrating because they're limited to a number of pages or a certain percentage. And if you do work with aggregators, aggregators tell us this is because the publishers will it this way. So the message I would say is DRM is not a good thing. And I really don't believe that students are going to pirate it all over the internet. Something that comes across to me quite often, a student comes up to me or, funnily enough, a member of staff comes to me and says, I can only see the first page of this chapter. And I say to them, okay, have you clicked the right arrow? And they go, right arrow? Why can't I scroll down? The internet for them is a different experience to a book. The turning the pages using the right arrow thing, they find incredibly frustrating. It's funny, isn't it? so they don't see an ebook as a book in terms of turning pages right and left. They see it in terms of scrolling pages up and down like a web page. They find the need for additional plugins to access certain features confusing, deeply confusing, and particularly off campus. On campus, we've put the plugins onto the computers, so they don't need to do that. But they find that very hard. Not all of our users are very highly technically literate. They can use the internet because it's easy. Type something in, click go. But having to download software and cope with that, they hate. They don't use personal bookshelf features, as I've mentioned. And they find limits on concurrent access unhelpful and deeply confusing, again, because they get a funny message saying you can't access it because somebody else is accessing it. And that is not something that happens on the web, is it? They find that very strange indeed. And I would say, I think Daniel mentioned Adobe Digital Editions doesn't work on our computers. So anything that's in Adobe Digital Editions, our IT department has stopped us using it. From my point of view, obviously I'm a librarian, I love books, I have stacks of books at home, I buy print books, I don't actually use e-books at home, I have to say. Books are books because they're not journals or databases, they're different things. I'm talking to the converted, I know, but books are there as a book because they are written to be an entity unto themselves, not a continuous publication like a journal. So. Many books, not all of them, written to be creative, philosophical, to have a long argument, a complex argument that follows one step on from another step from another step. Now, if you're looking at an ebook as something that you disaggregate, make it chop up into little chunks, I think that is doing a great disservice to the book. It's not actually helpful. If your author wanted to write a journal article, they'd write a journal article, surely, not a book. Obviously, this doesn't apply across the board. There are plenty of books that you can make into databases, reference books, monograph series, and collections. But I would say that a monograph is meant to be an entity unto itself, and that you shouldn't make it hard for a reader to be able to read it from cover to cover. Okay, they might not want to, but you should make it so that they can, and DRM stops that almost entirely. some more student comments about DRM, just to labour the point. These are real comments, they're from Surrey students. Existing copyright laws are frustrating as printing off text from e-books makes it easier to read than reading vast amounts of text online. Looking at the screen hurts my eyes and gives me a headache after a short period of time, and my concentration goes rapidly. It's quite difficult to physically read things while on the computer screen. When I've needed books, I usually print the main parts I need and ignore the rest, which is a bit sad for that particular book. I don't really see why I shouldn't be allowed to print more than 10 pages or so. That's just silly. And that's just silly comes through a lot to us. So, three simple rules from me. We'd like to have the titles we want available online simultaneously with the print publication, if that would be at all possible. We want things to be simple to find, access and navigate, so as simple as you possibly can make it, and we want it to be easy to use the text offline as well as online. My fourth simple rule is make it cheap. If you're going to try and sell through to students, that's got to be pence. It really has. And okay, you may get lots and lots and lots of pay-per-views at 2p a time from thousands of students, it may well rack up, but it's got to be dead, dead cheap. So, final comment is from another student, they are a work in progress. They like them, they're not there yet. Okay, thanks very much.
I think what we'll do is we'll hold our questions to the end. We'll just go through the three panelists and then come back and you can query us all in one go.
This one?
Our next speaker is Roel Tilley, and he is currently contract manager and senior policy advisor at the University of Maastricht. And he's going to focus a little bit more on the frustrations, or what he calls the bumpy road, to actually purchasing and acquiring ebook content at the university.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me here. maybe one or two things I say before starting my presentation. Contract manager might be a new idea for you guys, but at the University of Maastricht, it used to be acquisitions librarian, or chief acquisitions librarian, as you'd like to call it. Another part is the learning resource center. The library is divided into two parts. We have our traditional library, where we have the books and the bookcases down in the basement, and our resource center is where the students can get their books, and the books are there in one or sometimes many copies. They have videotapes, we have anatomical models and everything. So that's a center where they go to study and get all the information that they need. The University of Maastricht, it's the newest university in Holland, started in 1974. We have about 12,000 students, 3,500 staff. The university library is divided into two sites. The Randwijk site, where we have faculty of health and life sciences and psychology, and the site on the inner city, where we have law, economics, and cross-cultural studies. Both have, what we call the learning resource center, and are a bit different, as you might imagine. For law, you need something else for medicine. We have a problem with storage and student access, because we got into new buildings and the students are using the library more and more often than we thought, so we need additional space. The idea was then to take these learning resource center and transition them from print to folio. That would save a lot of place, bookcases, and we'd have more room for the students. So the scope of the project was to gain experience in handling e-books, in the process of acquisition, cataloging, and availability. That's where we started down, and one of the other aims was to cut down the photocopying activities. Students photocopy very, very much. To introduce the faculty to the e-book possibilities, because as my previous speaker says, sometimes it's difficult for faculty to convince them to make funds available and the product available for students. They still like books. And to gain commitment at faculty level. To clarify this, at the University of Maastricht, the library doesn't have any budgets. The budgets come from faculty. They have to make the funds available for the media that we buy, books, journals, databases, and everything. So if we gain their support in setting up, let's say, our budgets, then it might be easier to make the transition from print to e, which is more costly, as that's what I'm experiencing. To give you some idea, we were looking at the Faculty of Health and Sciences to look at the Learning Resource Center, what we have on books. I'm not talking about journals or anything else, just plain books. The Resource Center contains about 6,000 volumes. These volumes represent 1,800 titles. You can see for certain curricula and certain courses, we buy one, sometimes 20 volumes of the same book. My board of directors says, all you do is go to a publisher and you buy 6,000 books and we're finished, and it must be a very easy way to go. No, I looked into it. These 1,800 titles represent 60 publishers. There the problem starts. All different types of contracts and models. The average is 10 titles per publisher that we buy on an annual basis. So that made it difficult. And then one more difficulty added on top of that was that 50% is textbooks. And textbooks are very difficult to get in an electronic version. Our current book policy at the library is we have three channels in which we buy books. Bookseller A, where we buy all our Dutch publications. Bookseller B, where we buy all the foreign, due to contracts that we have, makes it a lot easier. And ad hoc, that means materials that you don't buy through normal channels. Then the next problem, let's say acquiring the e-books. In the folio, everything was clear. You go to your bookseller, you say, I want these books, you look some books and prints, you look some other database, you find what the book is costing, you buy it, and you put it in your library, and that's it. It was a quite easy model. You knew exactly, you could budget on it and things like that. We knew the number of books that we're going to buy, and we knew what the conditions were. So there was no problem. Each year, you draw up your budget, you buy your books, and that's it. The e-books is a relatively new field. What we ran across is current booksellers, the booksellers that we're working with, are not into the e-book business and not in the SDM e-books. It's a new field for them. They think they're going to have to invest in setting it up or providing the e-books for the library, so they're reluctant in supporting this. The bookseller is not clear on what is the availability, and the availability on a long term. At a library, we have books in our cellars for hundreds of years, and we want to keep them there, and we want to have them available. So access policies, we want the books that we buy electronically fully campus-wide available on a 24/7 basis. And that multi-user availability, so all students can use them at any time, anywhere. And then another problem was, of course, the cost models. I can't make my budgets at this moment because all the models are differently by certain publishers. We've been looking at this, even at the UKB, that's the Dutch Consortium for Libraries. We set up an idea of what the necessary rules and guidelines that we need for purchasing e-books. So if anybody's interested in that, I can send you that line. But my intention was of making this presentation is trying to put across to you the problems that we have in acquiring books. We want a simple way of buying books. If it's one or many copies, it has to be fully available campus-wide for all students. That's the models I'm not getting from the publishers. Publishers offer me packages or other types of deals, and we're interested in buying single titles at one moment and having available in continuity for all students at any time. Thank you.
Final speaker is Jill Taylor-Rowe, and she's currently the head of Liaison Academic Services and Special Collections at Newcastle University. She is a member of the GIST National eBook Observatory Project, and a lot of her insights will come from her work with that group.
Right, thank you very much. Can you all hear me? Yes, it's a pleasure to be here again at STM. I must say I was delighted by Richard's comment at the outset, where he said how important it was for you publishers to form working relationships with librarians. And I couldn't agree more with that, because I think some of our checkered history over ebook development, we do rather feel that maybe that relationship hasn't been as strong as it might be. But let's hope things are about to change. When I was preparing for this presentation, I was very conscious, looking back through previous things I'd done, that certainly I, and I think we as librarians and publishers as a whole, we've been talking about e-books for an awful long time now, haven't we? 8 or 9 years, I think. And whilst we've undoubtedly made some progress, it's been frustratingly slow. And many of us are longing for a trigger or catalyst that's going to move things forward. And I want to reflect in my presentation on some of the experiences we've had at Newcastle and indeed are having. But I also want to set this very much within the framework of the JSC Books Observatory project, of which I am a board member, not least because I think it's actually this project, as well as a few other things, that's really going to give us the trigger to move things forward. As I mentioned earlier in response to a question, 48,000 responses we've had to the two JISC surveys, which we reckon makes it the largest e-book survey ever undertaken. And if you say, is that an indicator of how important or how interesting e-books are to academic libraries? Well, I think that's very strong evidence. And what's good, the responses came from all of the stakeholders in the university chain, academics, librarians, and students. So we think it's pretty representative. And whilst it was quite clear that librarians have been the driving force in terms of interest in e-books, it's clear now that you've got a generation of students who would barely recognise a print journal if you forced them to go and look at it. They want access to e-versions of the key resources as well. When I talk to students, and I admit I don't do as much of this now as I used to, but my staff do, they all think about stuff. They want the stuff to do their assignments. And there's a lovely quote in the JISC survey where we're asking about whether you've used e-books, saying, well, I'm not sure, I've used an e-journal. Is that an e-book? And I think that's indicative in a lot of areas where the stuff is digitally available. They won't necessarily make the distinction, and I think that's something that's important. We're also finding that teaching staff, and this picks up a point of Kate's, they are ever sensitised to feedback for these, not just in the National Student Satisfaction Service, which of course are made public, and parents have access to these when they're helping to decide where their kids are going to go, but also in curriculum review and board of studies, where the kids are complaining about lack of access to textbooks. Academics have to be seen to respond to this, because it all goes through academic audit, and we're just building up for one now. And they get hold over the coals if they haven't been seen to do something about it. So we're finding that's triggering a huge upsurge of interest in academics asking us about e-textbooks. And that's been quite a change. And they're not just interested in e-books. This, again, is a slide from the Observatory Project. Almost two-thirds of respondents to those surveys are already using them for work or leisure. So you're really pushing an open door here. And that all looks very promising, doesn't it? Well, what is interesting, if you now put that into actual spending terms, I was having a look at trends on the Sconnell statistics, which all the HE libraries contribute to. And you'll see, although it's growing, for the 06-07, which is the last full year the stats are available, total spend for UK academic libraries is coming in at just under 4 million, which isn't a huge amount, is it? Particularly when you put that within the context of our total book spend, which is coming in at over 52 million. So it's less than 8% is actually going on e-books. So although there's all that interest, in terms of what's actually being spent, I think it's still a drop in the ocean. And why might that be? Well, again, let's look back at the Observatory survey. These were the top 10 reasons. If you park to one side all the sitting on the fence, there's two of those, two sitting on the fence factors, you'll see that the real nub of the argument is focusing around the pricing and access models and the choice of content. And I think, although it's lower down, and I think this picks up on remarks from some of the speakers, I would also highlight this whole thing about discoverability, because it's an important issue for us, not just in terms of how we or academic staff find out what is available to buy in the first place, and that in itself is a challenge, but also it is how easy it is for users to find the material, because most of us in big academic libraries no longer have major cataloguing sections. We've long since cleared those out. We do very little original metadata. We want to buy it in. But as Kate said, we want good, accurate records that we can whack into the catalogue and make it easy for the punters to find, whether through the catalogue or Google or however they're coming to us. But it's the old thing, garbage in, garbage out. We need good data. And for e-books, generally, that has not been the case. So let's talk about business models. This has come up very strongly in the survey, and I think, to be fair to you publishers, it's quite clear that no one size fits all, and it was ever thus. So I appreciate that that does make it harder for you when you're experimenting in what is still a developing market in terms of knowing what might work for you. However, something I would like you to put into context, and this is derived from research that I've been doing. One of the most vexing questions around ebook purchasing models is whether you go for capital or recurrent, which is a one-off purchase in perpetuity or annual subscriptions. And again, I, to be fair, I don't think there are easy answers. Although it's quite interesting now, we're seeing a lot more hybrid models where there's maybe a larger one-off fee and a smaller annual maintenance fee. But the point I think you need to be aware of, with the economic downturn, and specifically the pressures placed on academic library budgets by the plummeting value of the pound against our major currencies that we buy in, most academic libraries are positing shortfalls this year, quite significant ones. And whilst the major concern for most of us has been shoring up the serials fund, we are looking critically at all current recurrent expenditure. So in the current climate, e-books are in the frame as well, particularly those on recurrent. Traditional book funds, the source of the one-off e-book purchase for most of us, are just as vulnerable. And the slide I put up, I did quite a large survey of UK academic libraries, and I was asking them how they were managing the shortfall this year. And the figures in brackets are where they were getting the money from this year. And you'll see most of us were getting it from extra funds from the university. That's been fairly constant. Book fund, poor old book fund, being cut. Not so much from serials. And nothing much from big deals yet. But looking ahead to 2010, and this slide is for 2010, so it's asking what's changed. So less trawl from the book fund, slightly, significantly more coming from the serials fund for 2010, and big deals are vulnerable in 2010. And the same thing, we're all going to be trying to go with our begging bowls to the university for more money. Whether we'll get it or not is another matter. But you can see that the book funds have been trimmed. They will continue to be hit. And the serials funds will get a little bit more. But for your perspective in selling e-books, when times are hard, there's even more of a requirement that you come up with good and fair pricing models. Because in a time of financial hardship, if we're in any doubt, they won't even get past first base. So do think about that when you're putting things out to market. Usage data. Well, we could spend ages on this, but we won't. Whilst we certainly spend quite a lot of time on these at Newcastle, and that's largely because I've got a capable and enthusiastic colleague who's happy to do them for me, we are far from confident at this point that we're getting meaningful data from the e-book collections. And it isn't just that the variety of purchase models make it quite difficult in terms of how you work these out, particularly with things where it's a one-off fee and you're trying to work out a sort of return on investment over a fixed period, but even the recurrent stuff. And I've just got a couple of slides. This one was an e-book collection, counter-compliant, hallelujah, wish a few more were, and on the face of it, these chapter requests, nearly 10,000, looks at 38p per request, looks to be reasonable value for money. And I think we do actually have other data on this particular collection that suggests that it is. We've got whole modules built around the use of books in this collection, so we're reasonably happy with that. But there's another one, an individual title this time, and it's talking about full content units requested. It isn't counter-compliant, and although on the face of it that's looking quite high, my colleague who's working on them is digging a little bit deeper, and he thinks some of the things are over-counting, so we're less sure about that. And then there are other one-off books that we bought, particularly reference books, which have been particularly expensive. When we look at them, and they're getting tiny hits per year, and we're looking at, it could be 15 years before we actually feel we've got a return on that investment. Well, that's just not good enough. So I think there are all sorts of things that we're concerned about in terms of minimising risk and demonstrating value for money, which have always been important, but when the going gets tough financially, are going to be even more so. How do users want to access ebooks? It's quite interesting, without having talked much together, we do seem to be touching on some similar things. This whole question of how they use them has come up more recently with us when one of my staff was demonstrating ebooks to a cohort, and one smart student said, well, would it work on his Kindle? And she had to say she didn't know because we didn't have one. As she happened to have some research money, she's actually bought a whole range of readers at the moment, and we're playing around with them. Not just having fun, we've actually got students, academics, postgrads, library staff as well, because they were desperate to have a play with them. And she's actually got a questionnaire, so she's asking them to look at various resources, to feedback how easily they found them, what they were actually doing with them. Because one of the questions she had was, well, should we be offering a range of these readers to loan out as we do laptops? Now, I'm not convinced. Slightly different reasons. I think they want all things on one piece of equipment. And I think it would be a transitory thing if we got them. I think the iPhone model possibly might be, and I also like Kate's idea about the netbooks. But it's interesting that the questions are now being asked. The affluent students, the gadget freaks, are certainly going to want to download them in that way. And we feel we at least need to be able to answer the questions. You know, will this work? Are there any issues? So we're experimenting around with that, and I'm interested to see what others might be doing. Where do we go from here? Well, clearly, from my perspective, there are still not enough of the e-books that we want to buy. And one of the things we found a frustration in dealing with publishers is that you seem, or have seemed, very resistant to providing the things we know we want. We don't want huge collections of reference books. We want the textbooks, the things that 350 of them need to read one chapter of this week. And we're not sure even the ones that we have bought are providing optimal value for money. We know from our own consultations, which are backed up by the GISC surveys, which, you know, we really do feel have legs, that students are interested. And the GISC has also demonstrated, as was mentioned earlier, that where the e-versions are available to libraries, it has not had the detrimental impact on print sales, which is what many of you feared and gave as arguments to librarians as to why you wouldn't license the e-versions for us. Something else I would have you consider. Kate talked a little bit about how students manage their lives, and yes, many of them do have jobs, but of course in the economic downturn, many of the soft jobs, the casual labour jobs that students went for, have gone. And our university, in conjunction with many others, when I've read things in the Higher, are finding that the demands on the student hardship funds are soaring because they can't get the casual work. Now, within the climate that Kate had already outlined, where buying books was fairly low on the priority, if you're struggling even to get the money to pay your fees and your accommodation, then buying books is even lower down on the agenda. So recognising that is going to put far more pressure on the libraries. The academics will expect us to be buying them. So I'm afraid the push towards you actually loosening up about providing access at a library institutional subscription level for some of these e-books is actually getting even greater. So it seems to me to make perfect sense to start looking at business models which meet your business needs, but also are actually responding to a need that we feel we've been articulating for a long time and haven't really seen much movement on. Fortunately, I do think help is at hand. In addition to following up on our two big surveys with the Observatory project, we're also launching this second project at the moment to look at economic textbook models. And we will be piloting, we're working with publishers, working with librarians, to use some of the real stars, the cash cows books, to experiment in a safe environment to see what really happens with these. We're also involving aggregators to see if we can really move forward and make that quantum leap that I mentioned at the outset. And I actually think we can. We've had a lot of publisher support in the early consultation for this, and at the moment we're just finalising who's going to work with whom in which pilot. And just to conclude, looking back on the last 8 or 9 years, working with e-books has been like travelling down a long and winding road with no real feel that we're actually getting anywhere. I actually think now the time is right for that change, and it's time we headed out into open sea, and I think we can do it. So thank you very much. I hope we'll have some good discussion thereafter.
Okay, we have about a half an hour. We're ahead of schedule here for questions, so I'd like to open it up to the group.
Who's going to? Okay, Martin. I'm coming.
Hi. Jill, it may well be I haven't read down the bullets. Could you give us a little bit more detail about the next phase of the Observatory project, and indeed, you know, what models are you looking to explore?
Gosh, I can't tell you off the top of my head. I don't know how much of it's in the public domain yet.
Okay.
We've got a meeting on the 8th of May when we're formalising, we're canvassing for partners at the moment. So I probably better, I'm not actually sure whether it's out in the public domain, but there will be stuff that goes up on the website about it, and we're really excited. Some of the work has been done with Content Complete, mm-hmm. who manage the journals contract, and so you know, a lot of good relationships, a lot of respect for Albert and Paul. So they've been doing the work with publishers to identify those who are willing to participate in pilots, and I think it is just a case at the moment of marrying up the publishers who have expressed interest in particular models with libraries, very small groups of libraries who are willing to partner with them. So it's probably better to say, watch this space. There will be some information coming out about that very soon.
Yes, just a second.
Hi there, I'm Vincent. By day, Vincent Cassidy, by day I'm Commercial Director of British Standards. By night, I'm a student at Birkbeck. And I just wanted to get your comments that in my experience as a consumer, a recent consumer, whereas the journals technology works and is a pleasure to use mostly, the e-books are very difficult to work and very confusing. And before we talk about business models, there's a lot of work to be done on the technology itself.
You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Agreed, totally.
We had one instance at the moment, and I won't name the publisher, but there's a package of books that we have of theirs, and it's a real problem moving across to Shibboleth, you know, to the sort of standard authentication using their ID and password, and that the first time they try to do it, it tells them they don't have access. And when we contact the publisher, if you press it twice, it'll be all right. But what user faced with a failure in terms of saying, no, you don't subscribe, is necessarily going to have the confidence to keep pressing? And isn't that a negative response? So you're absolutely right. We've got a little bit of work to do with that.
Just a second.
Hi, I'm Kave from River Valley. Following on from the technology question, would it not simplify things if the ebook vendors would standardize on one format? And I'd suggest EPUB, which has which allows you to code everything in a nice way, so that that would make it easier also for the publishers. So they would only have to supply EPUB correctly formatted, and then you wouldn't have to worry about whether it's Kindle or Sony or anything else that comes, or iPhone that comes tomorrow. You simply create it, and you never have to look at that again. You don't in future have to. This is the normal XML argument.
Not being a technology expert, it's difficult to say what you would need to do. We find that there are many publishers that won't work with aggregators. There are some publishers that work with some aggregators and not others. In a library point of view, we'd like to work with aggregators that work with our print book suppliers so we can make our workflows very easy, so we can buy a print copy and an e-copy at the same time, for example. But sadly, we can't get the titles through the particular preferred suppliers. So from our point of view, yes, technology standardisation, great, but title standardisation would be way better.
Yes, I agree with Kate. That's the problem we're running into in searching for a way to present e-books, is that you have to go to too many channels for providing them to your students. You have to go through one aggregator or another aggregator, that publisher works with that aggregator, and it gives us a lot of problems. It's the biggest problem that we encounter in providing e-books for students. But we as a librarian, we can't do very much about that.
I must admit, perhaps I can be the fly in the ointment. I'm much less hung up about aggregators, partly because we've never yet found a single one that meets all our needs. So what we like is the ability to link the e-books into the VLE, where they've got all the links to the journal articles and things, so that there's again, it's... If our one-stop shop, it might be the VLE for that particular module, so that there is absolutely no excuse that the student can't have access to the resources they need to complete that work. And it includes the lecturer's notes, there might be video things, all sorts of things. So I'm less bothered about buying things in aggregated packages, because I think across our wide range of subjects,
there's never going to be one aggregator that meets all our needs, but it's the flexibility of having them such where, certainly at undergraduate level, they want that book. That's what they need, because that's what they've been told to read. They aren't going to read lots of extra stuff, so having the ease to put that in somewhere where they can access it is really the area, that the direction that we want to go in.
Yes, Richard.
Hi, it's Richard Padley from Semantica. I just wanted to ask how important federated searching is in the kind of ebook platform environment, and how important that is to you.
Well, again, I'm a bit of a Luddite. My staff and I hate our federated searching then, because we think it's rubbish, quite frankly. It's certainly no good at doing detailed searching for journal articles. I don't know. I mean, some of the things, a product like eBoo, for example, you know, the electronic early English books online, you can see that some sort of the sophisticated searching in that, where you can search through trends across the years, that sort of package specific thing is great. But I think federated searching of ebooks, I'm not really sure that that's an issue.
Well, I think one of the problems is the sort of first generation of federated search didn't work, as Jill says, it doesn't work. There is a next generation of where you ingest, or some sort of host ingests a huge amount of metadata and then serves it out to libraries, rather than having to go out to every single different database and then produce the results. And that may be something that we need to look into, and it would actually work, for one thing. One of the problems is the phenomenal slowness of the whole thing, and the fact that metadata is in such different formats. It's not cross-compatible, basically. But I think what students would really like to be able to do is to go to their library catalogue. Well, they tell me this. I know this. They'd like to be able to go to their library catalogue, carry out a fairly sophisticated search, and get access to chapters from books, journal articles, snippets from blogs, audio tracks, video, the whole gamut, print books, Google book search, you know, the list goes on. And they'd like to get it all through one interface. And I think it will come. It's not there yet, though. So it's important, but it's a technology that's not really there yet.
There's also real problems of keeping the knowledge bases up to date. We've had real problems with that with journals, where things have moved publisher, or you just feel that nothing's working to actually speed the access. I think, yes, if things improve, as Kate says, it might be better, but at the moment, it's not there.
Yes, I'm sorry. Just to follow up to that question, and I just throw this out as a question for discussion, with a Google. Yeah. I mean, isn't Google really the ultimate cross-search federated everything?
Yeah. Unfortunately, when you cross-search with Google, you get such an amount of complete dross. it's not great for academic searching. If you use Google Scholar, it's very limited, because it's only searching through those publishers that have made agreements with Google. And that is not necessarily books. It's a lot of journal databases and open access repositories, which is good, and people use it and they like it, but it's not going out to those different media, it's not going out to YouTube and all the rest of it. So you've got a bit of there's a gap in the middle between the Google massive search of everything and the scholarly search on Google.
Joachim Engeland again. Also into the same direction, but more a question to the publishers. Are you prepared to send metadata on chapter level, and allow libraries to store it, or other partners in the industry, intermediaries? And second part of the question, would you allow libraries to index the full text, or not just libraries, other parties in the industry, to index full text in order to make the book content more findable than it is obviously with just the title level metadata, which is fairly rough and not very handy and really searching ebooks.
So I'm going to take that up, publisher.
Interesting.
Okay. Just to let you know, we have about 15 minutes before the chef is ready for us, so start thinking of some more questions.
Erica from Springer Verlag. I guess publishers are able to send the data in chapter formats. We have it on link in chapter formats. And I guess all the other parts will be a kind of commitment that publishers and companies and libraries will do with the with Springer. But I guess, or with the publishers, it's possible to send not only the metadata. In Germany, we have the Libreka, for example. We are in agreement with them. Can I add another question? I have to wait. Now I have. Is it okay? So technically, it's possible, but the rest is in a kind of agreement. I have a question. In which kind of time frame you need, for example, the MARC records? Daily, weekly, monthly? That will increase the visibility for the students?
Hourly.
That's an answer. Hourly.
Real time. When we buy the book, we want to have the MARC record.
As soon as the book is really online, you need the
As soon as we've bought the book, we want to make it available to the students.
Okay. Thank you.
But also, as well, if I could add to that, before we get to that stage, make it easier for us to find out what you're actually offering. Because my staff get lots of queries from academics who are preparing modules and saying, can you tell me, is there a good, I don't know, microbial ecology book that I can cite that's electronically available for a module where I expect 350 students? And it is just not easy to do that. So you're missing a sale, a potential sale, because we haven't got time to surf around and spend ages trying to find out what might be available. So I do think you could sharpen up your market, well, get the right products available anyway, but sharpen up the marketing so we can find out what's in there in particular disciplines, because that would be enormously useful.
We don't all have Nielsen Book Search. We can't afford it anymore.
Yes.
And faculty members are not prepared to look at the newest editions. They want to get it. They want to get their attention drawn to it. So it's up to you as a publisher to reach out to faculty and let them know what's on the market.
That actually circles back to the metadata question. And if we had our metadata at the right discrete level, and we could push that out pre-pub, post-pub, and whatever, then there could be a vehicle there in combination with Google or whomever to index that information and get it out. I know at Wiley we do index or we create metadata for our books at the chapter level. And that is XML.
Question here?
Yeah. Hi, Emerson Samuels from MarkLogic. One of the implications from the Google settlement was to set up this books rights registry. Do you think that's going to help with the metadata problem, the fact that with this rights registry that everybody need to syndicate content to, or syndicate metadata to this rights registry to help?
As I understand it, it's only a US settlement. It doesn't affect UK.
Right.
Am I wrong?
I pose the question, no.
It's not under UK law.
Ron McMillan, American Psychiatric. It is US only as far as the settlement, but as soon as the settlement is in place, Google intends to offer subscriptions to institutions to large collections of the 10 million books that they've got. Presumably that would be worldwide, especially since the books are out of print, et cetera, et cetera. But I wanted to ask the question related around this. It sounds to me like this is in part the answer you're looking for, that if you knew you could have them have access through Google at a price you could afford, it seems to me that a lot of what we've been talking about is going to be available by the end of the year.
If they're large packages, that might be difficult. As Jill was saying about the...
They're not what?
If they're large packages, that might be difficult from a cost point of view.
The money, yes.
I agree. I think there's a problem from the other end in that we're such a small piece of a package that it's hard for us to figure out how we would relate to it. But our talks with Google at this point indicate that they're going to be, like the user, pretty flexible, and it may take them several months or longer to come up with packages that people will accept. But it just seems to me they know what the need is, and they're trying to figure out how to do it.
But my experience is that with packages that you're always buying a lot of books which you don't really need. With the journals, that was a different story, because we bought that, at least if from my experience in Holland, we bought it as a consortium, so you can divide that among a lot of libraries. But if you go into book packages, it's only locally that you need these books, and then the packages are usually, you have to buy many packages to cover the needs of your own institution, and that gives you problems.
Mm. Why not make up an e-book consortium? That's actually a question that I've
got one.
It doesn't work.
Well,
we can't agree on it.
We've got one. That's what JISC was set up for. But the antecedent to the Observatory project, which is the JISC eBooks Working Group, which I'm also on, we spent 2 years trying to get publishers to come and negotiate for national deals. And all of the, apart from the few that we got going, which are mostly for reference books, all of the things we wanted, you wouldn't license. So we do actually have a national licensing body for UKHE. But thus far, we haven't been able to get enough of the content that people want. And even with the Observatory project, the fact that we only got 36 books for 127 institutions wasn't for want of trying, but most of the publishers weren't prepared to risk their good content. So I think there has to be a willingness to parley on this front, but there certainly is a national negotiating body who would be delighted to do business.
One of the things that I felt was a recurring theme in all of these discussions was this emphasis on textbooks. And we started the day by saying trade books a little different, trade publishers a little different, but I think one of the elephant in this room right now is textbooks a little different. We're all running after ebooks, but we're saying we're going to take our time on textbooks. Mm-hmm. But what I'm hearing here is one of the biggest demands that you have is a need for textbook material mm-hmm. in ebook format. Could you talk a bit about the varying levels of demand between what seemed to be a very strong student-driven request mm. versus maybe researchers and your academics and what they're looking for, textbook, monograph, references?
Well, certainly, you're absolutely right that from a student level, we're serving 18,500 students, and it's textbooks that are needed. And particularly the way, and I don't know whether UKHE is different in this, in very few disciplines will there be a single book that they're reading from cover to cover. In most instances, it's chapters. They're actually using the chapter as a unit of reference. And the reading lists that we see are a mix of chapters and journal articles. And that's the real problem, because 50% of what they need they can get under our National Site License Initiative products, and then the e-book chapters are what they're struggling to get access to. And from our perspective, buying 50 print copies for 300 students just doesn't work, even if we make them hourly loans. They don't want that. They don't want to have to come into the library. They don't want the fine. So there's a real disjunction there. From an academic point of view, a lot of the things that come out, research monographs, we wouldn't necessarily buy those electronically, because research monographs tend to be things that are really for the humanities and social sciences. If it's a research monograph in a STEM subject, I would question whether how current and up-to-date that is, because the vehicle for the current stuff surely has to be the journal article. At a research level, so we're not really interested in buying research monographs. The sort of things we buy, and again it's arts and humanities, are these big digitised historical collections like early English books, 18th century collections online, which the punters love and are actually used for teaching as well. So I think there is a dichotomy, but given that you're STM publishers, I would say very much the demand for your material is not your reference books, it's the sort of textbooks that will be used in scientific undergraduate degree programs. And I don't know whether Kate's and Rule's yes. experiences are different.
Our experience is the same as I showed you on my presentation. Mm-hmm. The textbooks are very important for our resource center, learning resource center, and there are no, or they're not available, or there are no appropriate models which we can work with. Of course, we understand the fact that, as I said to other colleagues, we understand the fact that if we have, let's say, 1,000 medical students coming in on first year, that they're going to buy a lot of textbooks, and perhaps there's going to be a problem there in how you're going to kind of cover the costs, but the library cannot afford to pay 1,000 licenses. We are willing to talk about it and find a model, but there is no model, or simply the textbooks are not available, and that's the problem that we're running across.
I think one of the things from my perspective is there is a question mark over what is a textbook, and it differs in different disciplines vastly. For chemistry, you will have a textbook you do read from cover to cover in your first year. It's the chemistry textbook. But if you're a law student, you'll be looking at several different types of law, and within each different type of law, you'll be looking at 6 or 7 different books. And we're modularized now, so every student may be actually attacking 6 or 7 subjects in a year. If you're expecting them to buy 6 books per module per year, they're just not going to do it. That's just cloud cuckoo land. They want the library to be able to provide that access. And in certain subjects like law and like business, we have a massive problem trying to find texts for them. Mm-hmm. They have really huge cohorts of students, and they are very book heavy. Lots of different texts are put on their central reading lists. So rather than having 1 or 2 textbooks for a course, they're literally going 20 or 30 recommended texts, which they can't afford.
Something as well that fits into this, the widening participation agenda, where the government is pushing universities to increase participation from low socioeconomic groups. That's having an impact, because particularly in areas like medicine, which would fit Kate's pattern of chemistry, where there may be 1 or 2 texts they use all the way through, traditionally is recruited heavily from middle-class families, lots of them parents or family adopters. They're very conscious of having to widen that socioeconomic group and get people in from disadvantaged backgrounds. And the big push then that the faculty tells us is you cannot assume that these poorer students are going to be buying the textbooks, so there's even more reliance on us. And because they spend so much time out in hospitals, well, you can guess it. What do they want? They want the key texts to be available electronically. So if they're up in a little cottage hospital somewhere, they can still have access to the core text. So that's another driver pushing us around to get access to material that you perhaps would traditionally have assumed was largely going to be sold to the end user, i.e. the student.
And the other discipline there is nursing, which has always been targeted towards the lower socioeconomic backgrounds anyway, and they are out in hospitals all the time, and they've always wanted online material, and it's difficult to get the textbooks for nursing online.
This is directly to Kate, but for the whole, at least initially, you state you have access to over 160,000 ebooks. Can you tell us what various models you're having to deal with to buy these, and what access looks like? I know I'm throwing the gauntlet out there, but
right,
yeah, and okay. So and then, but not only tell us what you're how you're buying, but what you prefer, and then what models you see you would even be more attracted to. I know it's unlimited access, but...
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk historically. like Jill, I've been involved with ebooks for 7, 8, 9 years. Right back at the beginning, we began with NetLibrary as the first aggregator that was out there. And also... CRC, NetBases, we started, because we are very heavily towards engineering, and they had good engineering books. We then started with, we ditched our quick reference collection in print, and we went with some quick reference type databases, No UK, Credo, it used to be XRefer, those were our next ones along. We started taking in, let's see, what else? eBrewery, we had a large academic collection, a growing collection from eBrewery, and I wanted to go for that because it would give us a lot of marked records in our catalogue, and it would actually showcase ebooks. A lot of those books aren't read, they're not even in our subject areas, but it does mean that we've got a lot of e-links in our catalogue, and people are now aware of ebooks. One of the big packages that makes up a lot of the titles is EBO, Early English Books Online, which is 100,000, so that's a lot. And then most recently we've started going through a different aggregator, My iLibrary, which is resold through Coutts in the UK. And we went with them because of our workflows. We've always been a very lean team. We don't have an electronic resources team. I manage everything, whether it's print or electronic, on an acquisition side. So my print acquisitions team acquire ebooks too. We wanted a way of efficiently being able to order through EDI. And really, Coutts and My iLibrary were the only ones that would do that for a sufficient number of titles. The other aggregator that we could have gone with was Dawson Era. They didn't have the number of titles in our subject areas that My iLibrary did. Funnily enough, we used Dawson for our print book, so it would have been good to have had Enter Books, which is the Dawson ordering system for both print and e. And I'm actually under some pressure to go with Dawson as well as My iLibrary from my academic liaison librarian staff, who'd like to be able to just use Enter Books for everything, print and e, for the selection, because they use the library supplier's online system to do their book selection. They have set up subject alerts under Dewey system, so they know what new books are being published through. So again, going back to Jill's point that make your data available through these systems will actually filter through to the academic liaison librarians. They will select the books, we'll buy them. What have I missed? Lots of different things. But basically, we go through the aggregators to buy single books on a perpetual access model, so it will be single payment. We go through big databases for reference, so Credo Reference, Know UK, also OED, the big dictionaries, Oxford language dictionaries, so on and so forth. Basically, we don't buy printed reference books anymore. Elsevier, we buy some reference books from. All manner of different people we buy reference books from. And some publisher packages too. So a huge gamut. And we've had to do that because that's where the content is. And our users want the content, as Jill said. So we are kind of forced to go through all these different ways. Lots of it's on subscription. Lots of it's perpetual access. And I suppose it's horses for courses, really. I'm in a good position in that my job title is e-strategy and resources manager, so I can go to somebody and say, right, my strategy is we will buy e-books. Not everybody is in that strong position in terms of having an e-strategy person that is there to push that agenda. It can be fractured if the academic liaison librarians are the ones that make all the decisions on a subject discipline basis and they're only doing that with fairly conservative academics. Then they may not be able to push forward as far and as fast as we've been able to at Surrey.
Do you have a way to market? I mean, you talked about the lack of metadata. Hmm. Is there a way? Are there ways that you communicate with students? I know in the state there's a lot of, they send out alerts via email or text messaging.
Do you know? We've got a word for email, university email, which is university spam. They just delete it. The best way to market ebooks is to have the MART records in the catalogue by far and away.
Jill and Wiltek, you both mentioned earlier on what is an ebook, what is an e-textbook. Mm. I just want to pick up on something you were talking about earlier on, linking out to multimedia, video, yes, podcasts. How popular is that, and what could we do as publishers to better facilitate that?
I think you could do a lot more, because looking back over the last 9 years, one of the things that frustrates me is that I see a lot of the things that seem to be happening with ebooks is just replicating print in a digital format, and really perhaps that it's come about because the print books were born digital in terms of content, so hey, we could do something different with it. Our most popular ebook package by a mile is Novelle. Or novel, however you care to pronounce it, because they can download stuff, they can do things with it, they can play around with it in Excel, they can look at how solvents perform. They absolutely love it because it's interactive and it's doing things in ways that the printed book just didn't. And I feel there's a real missed opportunity. Now, there's always a danger, because I know some publishers I've talked to where you've got textbooks and you're marketing the websites where there are FAQs, diagnostic tests that the academics can use with the students. And certainly when we've tried to promote those to academics, you get that, not invented here, it's not mine, I wouldn't do it that way. So I do think you've got to be careful. But I think when you see how some of the more innovative lectures and things are developing now, the way that universities are looking at learning, you know, we've all got teaching and learning strategies, we've got quality in learning and teaching setups, where they are looking at delivering things in a more innovative way. I look at my son's school, where they've all got these smart boards, and you see how things are being delivered. And I did a general lecture at the start of the year for a sick colleague to a cohort of new students, and one of the lecturers came in with OHPs that he sort of peeled off and slammed on this antiquated piece of equipment. And I thought, what is a modern audience going to make of this? So I think part of it is understanding the way they are learning in schools and looking at some of the innovation and technology that's being used there. And I think you're missing a trick. We're missing a trick, and certainly our lecturers have been doing the same thing for 20-odd years, and it ain't broke, so I ain't going to fix it. They've got to smarten up, because I think the audience that are coming through are more discerning. They want learning delivered in different ways. They've got different learning styles. And it seems to me there's an awful lot of potential that hasn't really been mined yet, and that the e-book 5 years down the line could look radically different, or a certain type of ebook could look radically different. So it's that sort of thing, and some of it is derived from how I see the more imaginative users of our VLEs being developed, the younger academics, the stuff they're putting in the VLE, which isn't just flatly dumping your PowerPoint slides. They're doing some really creative stuff, and given that they may well be some of your authors, if not today, of tomorrow, they're the people I think you could work with, and with your own IT people.
I would agree with that. Just as an aside, really, I was talking to a group of library school students on Monday, and I got the evaluation forms back yesterday through the post, and it was very interesting because I did a very similar presentation to that on a completely different subject, but it's all bullet points and blah, blah, a few little pictures in. But what came across very strongly was they liked the content, but they wanted it to be more interactive and more visual. And actually, the products that we trial now in the electronic world are very much the visual, the videos of lectures collated together, mm-hmm. the audio, the streaming audio, being able to stop and start videos and annotate them. These are the ones that are catching the imagination of the academics and the students very strongly. If you trial a text-based resource now, they're like, meh, as they say. but the video one, they just love, and they want it in droves.
And that's what we are introducing in our course packs, that we have that we have the possibility of the deep linking, like Kate says. Yeah. You need more possibilities in another way of just presenting text. And so the deep linking has to be in the course packs that we present to the students.
I recall at the last Charleston conference in November that so-called patron-driven purchase was a hot topic. So the model where, I think it was an aggregator, I think it was Ebury, I'm not 100% sure, they would allow a library to, or their patrons to search on all the stuff that they have, and every time it is used, the counter is going one step further, and the bell rings, and you have bought another title. In principle, you can, of course, set limits and so that you stay in within your budget. Is this something that you have been looking at, or is this not under discussion in the European?
We have been looking at that, but the big problem is if you set your limits to usage, what are you going to do in September when the budget is gone and everybody's seen the book and everybody's used the data and all of a sudden you cannot present it anymore? That's a dilemma I don't want to, and a decision I don't want to make as a librarian.
I thought it was an interesting model. I was at the same presentation at Charleston. I thought it was interesting. And I think I would have difficulty, though, with my academic liaison librarians. but you can set the limits in very flexible ways. I think it was NetLibrary. Does anybody? Yeah.
Yes, someone's nodding.
Yeah, but the particular librarian that spoke about it was very enthusiastic about it. You don't necessarily have to buy the book. If you see it's just a few people have done it one day, but there's not sustained requests for it, then you don't buy it. There is still librarians to make the choice at the end of the day. So I did think it was very interesting.
Yes, it's interesting. It's managing the money, and I think certainly when we are driven at the moment by reading lists that the academics have recommended, how that would sit. One of the things we are actually doing, though, is partly as part of my campaign against why do you need a 600-item reading list, is that we are feeding back to academics what is actually used. You know, you thought you'd referenced all these 200 items. Did you know these are the only five that have been used? And it's partly this this is what the kids are selecting. And to feed that back in and to say, we think you ought to edit your list. Either you've got to promote some of this other stuff more strongly if you think it's valid, or you need to recognise that the consumers are making their own choices and this is what they're reading. And we're just starting that. We've actually got a few willing academics who are prepared to be shocked by how little the stuff they recommend is read. So I think a perception of things being user-led is certainly within our confines, but that sort of process will be interesting to observe. I would have worries about the money.
Any more questions?
Yes.
Oh, on the outside of the room. Thank you very much.
Hi, Chris Bennett, OUP. I wondered how much of a dilemma is it for you to choose between a subscription and a perpetual access business model? Is it purely dependent on the nature of the content you're dealing with? Does the budget push you in a particular direction?
Well, the big thing for me is I have a concern that the more my budget gets into recurrent, which is now a combination of journals, databases, and subscription e-books, the more vulnerable I am if I get a budget cut, because I've got to work rapidly to pull that back. Having said that, I've got to be absolutely confident if it's an upfront purchase for e-books, because we've had our hands burnt, particularly with reference material where we paid a one-off fee and the usage has been rubbish. I'd have to be fairly convinced from a trial that it was going to be worth it. So I think I'm at the moment, most of the ones we've got are on a subscription basis. And I think I generally feel more comfortable with that, provided that the usage is good and the subscription fee is not unreasonable. And certainly the last three we got have also been on a, where there was an upfront fee, a one-off fee for a large slice of the data, but then because it is going to be updated, there's a small annual fee. And that's one that we're looking at. So I think Cape May will be different, but I'm probably more comfortable with that, provided I know it's going to work, and I don't like too many multi-year deals, because that's the other problem again with recurrent. If you're tied in for a three-year deal, it can be difficult when you have a budget hit.
I would agree on the usage side of things. If something is going to be highly used, then I'm happy to pay, and it's going to be updated as well, that's the other thing. If there's going to be new content, and it's going to be good quality new content, I'm happy to pay a subscription. Just as an aside, one of the most successful models we've had is Safari IT books, where you'd pay a subscription, but you can swap out the titles,
yes,
which is fantastic, actually. It's a bit of a pain for cataloguing, but really, from the point of view of keeping the collection fresh and what the students need, it's great, because you can also see the turnaway statistics on the copies that you don't have access to, and that points you in the direction of what the students actually need. You get rid of the ones that aren't being used, and you put in ones that are being used or wanted.
You both mentioned usage. I'd like to ask how you measure or quantify what you consider good usage for a book.
That is really difficult, because it depends highly on the subject area.
Yes.
I don't think you could ever say one particular thing. When you've got a cohort of 300 management students, you're looking at a much higher turnover figure, whereas if you have 10 chemistry PhD students, good usage is one hit a year, perhaps.
I think the problem is, as well, we don't really know enough about what we think constitutes good usage of the print.
Yes, exactly.
Because
and
it's trying to find the equation, because I think with full text downloads for journals, we've tended to equate that to photocopied articles or the cost of an interlibrary loan. That's been the standard one, although even that I'm not sure we've quite got right. But it's actually quite difficult to think, what would you equate an e-book used too, and also the fact that everybody's measuring different things, so we can't even look across all our e-book packages and say, well, that's the per chapter cost. So I think the jury's out on that one. We like usage because if we're looking at recurrent expenditure and demonstrating value for money, which our paymasters want incessantly, we've got to provide something, and I really don't think we're quite there yet, but I think we need to do more work on it.
So you're finding how long is a chapter, what is a chapter?
Yeah.
Well, they're
exactly.
Very different, and
exactly.
Reference books are counted incredibly different to monographs. Yeah.
Well, the other thing we've been talking about is a measure of our failure to provide the right access to books is the length of the queue for reservations,
mm-hmm.
or the length of the complaints, mm-hmm. because we couldn't get it when we wanted it. If you had the E and the print, and both of those went down, I would actually take that as a measure of success, because we've satisfied the customer, and we haven't got a long list of complaints because it wasn't there. So there are all sorts of things that I think we need to take into consideration, and we're not quite smart enough with that yet.
One more question, if anyone has a question, and then we will... anybody on the panel have one more thing you want to say before we wrap up? Or save it for lunch? Whatever.
No, I think they're quiet.
Yes. Well, I hope you'll all join me in thanking Eileen and Jill, Kate, and Roel for a fascinating session. Really useful. Thank you very much for coming to see us.